Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to address the term solar punk in an easy to understand way in this little podcast. But first, I have to introduce ourselves. I'm Ole Jon Tveito, and my expert on this theme. You have to introduce yourself.
So my name is Rhys Williams. I'm a lecturer in energy and environmental humanities at the University of Glasgow. I'm in the English literature department. And my focus, and why I suppose you've asked me here today, is on narratives of sustainable and just futures with a focus on energy and food, which means that solarpunk is a future imaginary, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, and of course this is to be about solarpunk,
yeah.
The movement, the term, or origin, and to make us understand more about what solarpunk really is.
Mm-hmm.
But first, you've been attending as a lecturer at the first solarpunk campus in Rjukan as a lecturer. But could you say how these days have been here?
It's been fantastic. So we don't really have something like this in the UK system, where you gather lots of PhD students from different countries and you bring them all together for an extended period of time to think about, you know, a particular question. In this case, it was energy transition and, you know, just energy futures with a focus on narrative, which is why I was invited. And to bring them to a place like Rjukan, which is so beautiful, obviously, but also so relevant, right? So we went to see the hydropower station, which was really fascinating. And before I came, I didn't know very much about Rjukan. And it turns out it's this incredibly important place in the history of not just energy production, and obviously in the Norwegian context, but also the birthplace of artificial fertilizer. So bringing my two interests, right, energy and food, together, I feel ashamed that I didn't know about Rjukan.
It's about time
before,
then.
Right? Yeah. So suddenly I'm like, well, maybe I should move to Rjukan, and you know, and it's just been great. Lots of lecturers with lots of different kind of specialities and interests. The lectures have been fascinating, and then the welcome and the warmth and the conviviality of the solarpunk festival, and Margareta, and you know, providing the food and everything, and it's been lovely. Yeah, it's been less like work and more like play, for sure.
Yeah, you mentioned Margareta Brekke, and where did you meet her?
I met her online. She got in touch a long time ago now. So when we ended up at the Varlager, I saw on the wall, she's painted the wall, you know, with a scene, and at the top there are these letterings in Thomas More's Utopian font. And I remember when she first got in touch and we had a Zoom call, it was at the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, and she was in the middle of painting those letters.
Ah.
So they were half done behind her in the conversation. She got in touch because she was organising, or beginning to organise, the solarpunk festival, and she'd read some of the things I'd written, and she wanted to talk about it, and I was, you know, really interested and enthusiastic, and I said I would be a part of it. And then, you know, coronavirus and the various problems and so on, nothing really emerged from it immediately, and then 3 years later, here we are.
Yeah. And you've been here for days now, so you had some time, and someone said you even visited Mount Gausdal.
I did. I walked from Rjukan up to the summit.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, you're a mountaineer.
No, I'm not. My knees will tell you that I'm not a mountaineer. It took me 6 hours just to get up, and then I had a lift back with some very friendly local people, which was helpful, because I think I would have died on the way down.
Yeah, so you took the cable car
yes.
down.
Yeah. Which was fascinating. Yeah. Really interesting.
Okay. The subject. Solarpunk.
Mm.
What is solarpunk?
Solarpunk, for me, is two things broadly. It's an imagination of a just and sustainable future. So it's a utopian story. It's a set of short stories, usually with a couple of novels written by Becky Chambers more recently, which try to imagine worlds or futures where we have got a more equitable relationship to nature, to how we produce the things that we need to live, so energy, food, and so on, and also a more just relationship between people as well. So that's the kind of ideals behind it, I think. In reality, it's a series of collections of short stories, mostly written by amateurs. It's a set of aesthetics, which is to say, people enjoy the way that solarpunk looks, and they draw images of futures in a particular way. It has a sort of Art Nouveau kind of feeling often. They're sort of bright and shining kind of images. They range anything from technologically advanced cities with, you know, trees growing out of skyscrapers, and you will have seen this kind of imagery, I think, all the way down to the smaller sort of, I like to think of them as hobbit houses, right, from Lord of the Rings, like these little kind of sort of rural idyll kind of villages, but again with solar panels and some often very high-tech machinery, but which is always integrated into the natural world. And this is, I think, a really key aspect of it.
It sounds like some kind of a dream world you're talking about here.
It is. It is a dream world. Yeah, it is a dream world. So that's the imaginary part. And then the other part is, I think, more interesting in some ways. And I'll say why. So the imaginary part, as you point out, it's a bit of a dream world, right? It's a utopia. And utopias, traditionally, they provide an interesting critique of the present. They show us ways of thinking about what's wrong in the present. So in this case, harmony between urban and natural, or between technology and nature and so on, that's not the world that we live in. So solarpunk is a way of critiquing this and showing us that maybe, you know, the way that we live now is not the best way. But it's not a political program. Utopias do not tell you what to do, how to solve things. And thinking that they do is a mistake, right? So one of the ways that the solarpunk imaginary is used is as a way of pretending that what you are doing is somehow a positive thing. So it gets used by companies, for example. There's a famous solarpunk advert by a yogurt company that I won't name on the radio. And it somehow, in the way of all advertising, pretends that, you know, this yogurt company, which is there to make a profit and so on, is in some sense producing this utopian, beautiful future. But the more interesting side of solarpunk are the solarpunk communities, right? So the images and the stories, the most interesting thing that they do is they provide something for people to gather around. There are like a rallying point. Raymond Williams might have called it a scratch in the glass, which bubbles collect around, right? And this is the utopian function, I think, of solarpunk,
because the idea or the dream or something like that.
Exactly, yeah. Right? But the thing, what I'm driving at, I suppose, with this comparison between the way that companies have started to use solarpunk aesthetics and something like what's happening here in Rukan, which is a more grassroots, genuine attempt at community building, at living differently, which uses solarpunk again as a kind of rallying point and as a dream, but the content of the dream is different. And that's really the key, right? That's the thing that we always have to focus on. The utopian surface often can hide what's beneath, but it's the content of the dream that's important.
You know, to me, solarpunk was a quite new thing when I discovered it just some few years ago. But before that, I had heard a lot of and seen a lot of cyberpunk. But is that the complete opposite?
Yeah, interesting. So, science fiction is always about the present. It's a kind of an obvious statement, right? It's not really about the future, it's about the present. And cyberpunk came from a particular historical moment where it was both a criticism of and a sort of celebration of this kind of rampant capitalism, right? This kind of rampant neoliberalism.
Yeah, when we talk about cyberpunk, we think about robots, machines, grim future, kind of Terminator 2 world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you think about, so the Blade Runner aesthetics are the most famous ones, right? If you think about the scale of the cities, the size of the buildings, this is a future whose content is large corporations, right?
Like, and quite dirty.
And very dirty, yeah. Dystopian, right? Yeah. Dystopian. Yeah. So there is an interesting point of crossover. The first cyberpunk collection, as I understand it, was published in Brazil in 2012, and it was translated... Solarpunk collection,
We mustn't confuse here, no?
Did I say cyberpunk? The first solarpunk collection was published in Brazil in 2012, and it's not solarpunk as we would think of it today. So I would describe it as cyberpunk in solarpunk clothing.
So maybe some kind of emerging of the solarpunk out of cyberpunk.
Exactly. I think of it as this transitional moment. Yeah, because the stories are grim and about, you know, a detective, very classic cyberpunk kind of stories, but in a world with some renewable energy, basically. Yeah. And then from there, the solarpunk trajectory becomes more and more utopian, more and more this kind of struggle with our current ecological problems, our current kind of justice problems. It goes in that direction more and more until now it's, I think, a kind of fully understood imaginary.
So how close is solarpunk connected to the environmental problems we have today, then?
It's driven by it. I think that's its basic, along with social justice, but I think that's its basic motivation.
Yeah,
that's its reason for being. It is still, it's a broad church, right? There's lots of different kinds of solarpunk. Again, it's the content of the dream, right, that matters, and the content changes from dreamer to dreamer. So I know people who are really into solarpunk, and what they do in their day-to-day lives is they run permaculture farms, right? And so, you know, they're very interested in this kind of small-scale degrowth permacultural way of living. And then on the other side of things, you have people who like solarpunk, but who are heavily invested in the kind of technology advancement side of things. Yeah. And the politics of these things are completely different, but they unite under this idea of a greener, better, fairer world.
So it's quite a new movement, this, which is still emerging in a way. But you're in Rjukan, where you had this... this town is built on dreams and on making use of the power in the nature. And it's also about making fertilizer. Is Rjukan early solarpunk?
No. No, I don't think so.
But today, you could see it as a connection in a way, or would you? Is it natural that the Solarpunk Academy is in Rjukan?
It is natural. Yes. Although, I mean, natural is a difficult word, but yes, it is natural. But not because I would describe the foundation of Rjukan as being solarpunk.
Yeah, because it isn't.
Because it isn't. And I'll talk a bit about that, because I think that's interesting. So there is a famous... I need your help here. There's a famous Norwegian painter from the early 20th century, watercolors, painted a famous series of the waterfall for Samaida.
Yeah, there's so many who have done that. But,
right.
But Kittelsen?
Quite possibly. Yeah. Like very famous, like perhaps the most famous painter. And there were five images. One is the waterfall as a dragon, and then slowly images of him building the factory.
Yeah, Kittelsen. And he knew Samaida as well.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
He was asked to draw this. He was then a poor painter, but then, he's asked to do this for Samaida.
Right.
So Samaida hired him for 1.5 years to do this.
Right. So this series of five photographs, five paintings, which I only learnt about this week, obviously, I think they're really fascinating because what they capture is a narrative, a story of controlling and dominating nature. And at the end you have the final painting, everything is green fields and growing agriculture and everything is beautiful, but the natural world has been tamed in some sense. And this is the story of modernism, right, which is not the story of solarpunk, which is why I would claim that the beginning of Rukan is not solarpunk. But it's natural for solarpunk to be here now, because solarpunk is something which has emerged out of the death of the dream of modernity, right? So belief in progress, belief in growth, belief in technology dominating nature. If we can think of these things as not as persuasive or believable anymore. Obviously, plenty of people still believe in it, right? But if we think that perhaps these things aren't as believable anymore, then this kind of dream of a more equal relationship to nature, a more sort of give and take way of living,
sustainable,
this I think has a natural home in the ruins of the modern dream, something like this. No? Yeah. But it's more complicated than that because, the power plant, the hydro plant, it still produces a huge amount of electricity. The dream isn't dead, right? Mm. And it's clean electricity. So this is why I say that the specific content of the dream is important and not so much the aesthetics, right?
Yeah. But, well, it's a new moment. Movement this, but I read online that there was made a solarpunk community manifest in 2019. I don't know how much you know about it, but that means that there's a progress in this whole idea. It's a growing movement.
Yeah, definitely. It was, well, its growth has been online hugely for the most part. People from all over the world connecting to this idea of solarpunk through the internet, right, through the access that provides. The Solarpunk Manifesto, I think that was written by Adam Flynn, and it's an interesting document. It's an attempt to give some kind of canon, right, some kind of core or center to the movement. More or less successful, I think. But it talks about how it, as a movement, is against, the kind of capitalist present. Mm. It talks about one thing which is important from it is it focuses on infrastructure as a kind of political question. And I think solarpunk at its best does this, right? Which is an interest of mine as well, which is to say infrastructure is political, and when we try to build a more just and sustainable future, the infrastructure that we build to make that future happen, that's where the politics of that future come from, the way that we organize things,
But does that mean that solarpunk could be or become or will be a political movement?
Well, it what do we mean by political movement? I think solarpunks have politics. Mm. I don't think they have coherent politics. As I said, it's a broad church. Mm. And I think different people who identify as solarpunks would probably disagree quite strongly on the specifics of their politics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, focusing on the content is important. And it's why I was so pleased and impressed by what's happening here in Rukan, right? Because this idea of solarpunk as a way of creating a community and a way of changing how that community relates to the natural world through artworks, through what you might think of as infrastructures of culture, I think that's a really powerful use of solarpunk. Mm. So I applaud Margrethe for what she's done. It's really impressive.
Yeah, because the connection to art is basic, isn't it? It's and it's like this is an artistic movement in many ways.
Mm. Yeah, and there's not enough attention given to how important art is, especially for making big political changes like the ones that we need to see today.
Mm.
Everyone thinks about the technical changes, the economic changes, but art is how we relate to the world and to each other. Art is how we make meaning from the world, and we need new meanings to make a new world, right? To put it in the most grand way I can. But the work like, you know, Martin's Sun Mirror, changing the relationship of the people of Rukan to the sun in the winter. His new piece, the Riverbed, right, which was born out of a collaboration with the children of Rukan. And again, it's this piece of art which changes the relationship of the people, this time to the river, and to questions of property and ownership and who has control over the river, because as I understand it, the river is very controlled in Rukan by the industry and the government.
Mm.
This is art, right? This is interesting art.
But it's also progress, and it's also politics, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. That's why it's interesting, yeah.
You know, the solar mirror, it's a distraction from the whole thing, but you know, the Chinese had picked up the idea with the solar mirrors, you know, because they want to use big solar mirrors in space to make more sun down to their solar panels.
Huh.
that's kind of solar punk, isn't it?
It could be. Yeah, it could be. One of the solar punk imaginaries, which is very over into the like big, large scale. I mean, that would be a very technological and industrial achievement, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's big scale solar punk, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so art is becoming both future and industrial enhancements or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of special, but it's nothing new, is it? It's actually, if we go back, art has been important in also all kind of future development. We shouldn't go in there, but it's like art is important also in the future, let's say there.
Ah, okay, yes, yes. Art is important, yes. And it always has been, that's true. I suppose the point I was making was that increasingly, if you look at funding for humanities and arts programs in universities, if you look at the way that these kinds of topics or careers are talked about in the kind of public discourse, they are treated with less and less respect, I guess, and they get less and less funding. So art is important, but people don't seem to want to treat it that way nowadays, I think, increasingly. Maybe it's a little different here in Norway, I'm not sure. Speaking from the UK context, our humanities departments are, you know, in crisis, right? This is a conversation that's been happening for a long time, the crisis of the humanities.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's real. It is real.
Yeah, because our art is connected to prosperity and, well, let's say, richness.
Mm.
So the poorer society gets, the less important art seems to be.
Hmm, interesting. Well, with Britain, I think it's in some ways disconnected from that, because It's more that I think they the people who are in charge of the money, let's say, I think they find the humanities too critical. You know, art is not something which just applauds the status quo, right? And at the moment we need a lot of change, and we need it quickly, and art is a big part of calling for that change. And so this is beginning to become, you know, a large conspiracy theory now, right? But there is a sense in which people who don't like the humanities are people who like the status quo.
Yeah.
We could put it this way, maybe.
Well, we could talk about this for hours, and we can't. But we know that this movement is, you could call it, quite radical. At least compared to today's society, isn't it? I mean, we're in a day where we are living in, well, we're going towards this, you could call it, mega crisis. Maybe the foreseen future of world troubles. I don't know if I should call it a dystopian world, but there's at least a lot of it in all kinds of modern literature, films, whatever.
Yep.
So this is as opposed to this. This is a hope for a better world.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That we are going to change this and build a better world based on using resources in a proper way.
Yep.
And also, maybe also being friends with nature.
Yeah.
Instead of using all the resources and until they're used up.
Yeah. I like to think that culture provides what is needed when it's needed. So solarpunk is flashing up in a moment of danger, you could say. Because what we need, or there's lots of things that we need, but one of the things that we need is a sense of being able to do something. And that can only come from having stories in which we have the capacity to do something, where we understand ourselves to be able to act and change things. So dystopian stories are everywhere, right? Because they reflect the doom and gloom of contemporary society. It's an easy story to write. And it has been since, you know, the invention of dystopia, right? Because you focus on all of the ways that this could get worse. Or you focus on all of the ways that it is already very bad, right? And there's a sense in which solarpunk speaks to the present moment with the conscious intention of giving people hope and a sense that they can act. Whereas dystopias, often there's the protagonist who can overcome the whole dystopian world, right? But they are usually individuals, and the focus is on the individual. Whereas in solarpunk, the focus is on the community. And any real politics which will have some chance of getting us out of this mess needs a focus on the community, the group, solidarity, these kinds of questions. Yeah.
Listeners may hear a little sound outside our room here now, and it's an old diesel locomotive which is traveling outside here.
Diesel
and
punk.
Yeah, I probably, you know, this is we are sitting just beside an old railway, which was one of the first thing built in Rjukan. And this was also the first electrified railroad in Norway, you know. So but the electrification is now turned off, and it's a diesel engine, which also is running on this. So you have to live with that. But I guess that's okay, because we're talking about past and future. And what would you say is the future for the solar punk? Is it a bright future? Is this just the start of a big movement?
I don't know, obviously,
I'm asking you an expert.
Well, I suppose when I first discovered solar punk, when I first found it, I should say, I didn't discover it. It was a very small online movement, a few Tumblr pages, a few people who called themselves solar punk, and one, I think, or two amateur stories, collected stories. And as an academic who's interested in science fiction and futures, I thought, this is interesting, I'll write an article, and then I didn't think anything more of it. Mm. And then over the 5 years since then, more and more people ask me to talk about solar punk. There is now a solar punk community in Rukan. Mm. There's more and more of these things growing up and popping up, and I was surprised by that. It obviously... Well, firstly, I'm obviously no good at predicting the future, right? No. So this question is, you know, ignore my answer. But secondly, it obviously speaks to a lot of people. Yeah. Because coming at it from my kind of, you know, my academic or critical angle, what I wanted to do was talk about the things that I found powerful in it, but also to think critically about it. Mm. So my first work on it was to say, this is good and interesting, but also here are some problems, you know. And I didn't think that it would have the capacity to inspire quite as much as it has. I've been quite impressed. Yeah, I've been taken aback by it.
So it may be a big future movement.
Yeah, potentially. And especially, I think, the danger for me is if the aesthetics and the kind of attractive power of solar punk gets emptied out by corporations or, you know, businesses using it as a way of greening themselves.
Are you talking about yogurt companies now?
For example, yeah, there are other examples, right? There's the recent Disney movie is a solar punk world, but actually, if you watch that movie, the message of it is very confused, right? Yeah. It's, you know, like all...
Just like Disney.
Yeah, like all, you know, like all ideological kind of Hollywood movies, right? Yeah. Whatever. It's kind of about sustainability, but also kind of about growth, right? It's like, we want everything all at once.
I need to see that now.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating. Where was I? So my fear is that the attraction of it will get co-opted and hollowed out by people who use it but who use it to hide their status quo content, as it were, right? The hope for it is in things like the solar punk community in Rukan. These are the things that will make it grow sustainably, let's say, that will give it strength. The more of these things exist.
Well, then time will show, but you were mentioning a couple of movies here, and what if someone now wants to know more about solar punk? The internet is, of course, the place. But are there any movies, books, which is typically solar punk, or maybe recommendable or whatever? There's not many.
No. So
not yet.
Not yet. Yeah. So the best, I suppose, in terms of literary quality, the best solar punk stories are, as I mentioned, by Becky Chambers. She has a pair of books called the Monk and Robot series, and they are set in a solar punk world, and they capture a lot, I think, of the solar punk sensibility. And Becky Chambers is the perfect author, really, to write a solar punk story, because even before those books, her science fiction stories were very generous and kind, and they have an attitude. So the way I normally summarize it is, in the old days in science fiction, if you meet an alien, it's going to kill you. and you have to kill it.
Yeah.
But in Becky Chambers' stories and in some other science fiction now, if you meet an alien, it seems frightening, but the thing you need to do is try to understand it.
Okay.
And then it turns out that it actually doesn't want to kill you, and it has its own problems, and then maybe you can help it, and then you form a community. This is a kind of basic difference, I think, which is emerging in science fiction now, between the alien as scary and you need to kill it, and the alien as scary, you need to understand it. This is, yeah.
But then I must ask, because I've seen a couple of movies which obviously is not solar punk, but could be like giving me the associations of it,
mm-hmm.
like Annihilation,
mm-hmm.
The Arrival,
mm-hmm.
Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
Am I far out, or what would you say?
Yeah, interesting. Those are three very different films as well.
Yeah.
So, Arrival speaks to this thing I just said about needing to understand the alien. You know, they're not automatically here to kill you.
Yeah.
Everyone should try and understand the other, right? You should understand the other.
Yeah.
That's a big part of solarpunk. I wouldn't say Arrival was solarpunk, but it has that same ethos to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Black Panther is more complicated because it emerges out of a history of black utopianism, and I don't think that solarpunk has dealt very explicitly or very well with questions of race up to this point, at least not to my knowledge. There might be some new stuff out there that I haven't seen. But a strong critique of solarpunk, which I've certainly seen and sort of broadly agree with, is that it comes from a very white understanding of the world and the problems of the world, right? It doesn't really deal with race, except perhaps to just make it disappear, you know? So there is a utopianism to Black Panther, and there is an ecological harmony to it, but I would not want to conflate it with solarpunk, because I think they are two different things.
Mm.
Annihilation is more complicated, because that comes from a genre tradition called the weird, right? Or in this case, the new weird. So H.P. Lovecraft, William Hope Hodgson, these are the old authors of the weird, which emerges in the early 20th century, and the main feature of the weird is that it's horror, but the monsters are not like human monsters. They're not Dracula or Wolverine or werewolf, sorry, or ghost or anything like that. They are these unimaginable monsters, right? Like Lovecraft's kind of, I cannot describe it, and it's
something is threatening, but you don't know what it is.
Yeah, and even when you see it, you can't comprehend it, right? So it comes from this kind of tradition, and then the new weird is like China Mieville and Jeff Vandermeer, obviously, who wrote the book for Annihilation, and others. There are other authors, and this text by Vandermeer, it uses. It sort of collapses the weird with a kind of ecological horror, which is to say it's complicated, but it sort of makes nature weird. And I think the claim underneath Annihilation and the film to an extent as well is that nature is already weird.
Mm.
It's just that we pretend it's not, right? We ignore it and we pretend we can put it into a box and pretend we can control it. And actually, it's just there all the time, growing and changing and waiting to be weird, right? As soon as we turn our backs on it somehow. So it's an attempt to change the way we think about nature in a positive direction. I think it's a good direction to go in. You know, we can't just tame it. We can't just master it. It's a thing all of its own, and it's stranger than we can imagine. But it's not very utopian.
No, obviously, yeah.
So I guess that's why it's different.
But how about some Ghibli movies then? Like,
yeah.
Which is obviously animation, but just that's maybe more like it.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So the Studio Ghibli movies I often pointed to as a solar punk precursor, right? As something that came before and which is like solar punk. There are discussions about why it isn't solar punk, why it is solar punk, and so on and so forth. But yeah, broadly speaking, I think the way that industry is often in conflict with nature in those Studio Ghibli stories, and the way that the technology of the more sustainable societies looks, right? That kind of fantastical technology. I think, broadly speaking, it's hard to say that it's not very solar punky, because it obviously is a bit solar punky, yeah. But, you know, solar punk comes later, right?
Yeah. So, technically speaking, we could see in the future, maybe near future, we could see a lot of solar punk or solar punky movies. Like we say, see cyberpunky movies, which there are obviously a lot more of already.
The problem, I think, is narrative, yeah. Right?
Where's the bad guys?
Yeah. Where's the conflict? Where's the story? Another reason dystopias are more popular than utopias is because of the conflict.
Yeah.
So in the solar punk stories that I've read, the conflict is usually between someone who is resisting the transition and someone who, you know, wants to make it happen, this kind of thing. But there is obviously space for conflict. I'm not sure if you scale up that conflict to the size of a 2-hour Hollywood movie, how much of the solar punk that I find interesting, the politically radical solar punk, I'm not sure how much of that would be left in the film.
Yeah.
Maybe it would just be a story about heroes and villains in a shiny green world. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not easy to say that we will have a lot of culture spinning out of it in Hollywood or in literature. But it's going to be exciting to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you think solar punk has a bright future or not?
A bright future? I hope that things like the community in Rukan, I hope that more things like this happen. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I'm finding is people are asking me to come and talk to them about solar punk, who I would never normally expect to ask me to come and talk to them, right? So businesses and industries, so tourism industry, for example, if they're doing a sustainability conference, then I've been asked to come and talk about solar punk as a kind of image of sustainability, as a way of providing hope for the future. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, again, this is what solar punk does well, I think. I can go in and talk perhaps more critically than they're expecting, because solar punk has opened the crack and let me in. So yeah, I think that's what it's good for, maybe, from my perspective at least. And it's the same for, you know, this situation in Rukan. Solar punk is something which opens the way, maybe. But what matters is what you do afterwards.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we are near the end of this podcast. We could talk for hours about this, I guess.
This has been fun, yeah.
And I want to thank you for giving us insight into this, but I need to ask one question.
Okay.
Because solar punk is solar.
Mm.
It's always sunny.
Mm.
And it's connected to the sun.
Mm.
Could you please explain, is that, yeah, the sun is basic in this. Is it the life from the sun, or is it the use of the sun, the harvesting of the sun?
Oh, I see. Yes, yeah. So, it's difficult, I think, to write a positive and attractive future if it's very gloomy and dark. If you think about cyberpunk or Blade Runner or whatever, it's always very gloomy and dark, and that's a kind of aesthetic mark of bad future, right? So, yes, solar punk draws a lot on sunshine, light, warmth, this kind of thing. But there are examples of solarpunk stories set in winter, which use other renewable sources like water or geothermal. The solarpunk, I suppose, because it's a neat and bright sounding term. Also, I think because in the global north, at least in parts of the world where solarpunk emerged most strongly, like North America and the UK and so on, and Italy, I think the solar technology is perhaps the more charismatic renewable technology, right? It's the one that gains the news attention. It's the one which is being produced the most at the moment. It has the out of all of the new renewable technologies coming online year on year, solar takes up the most of the new power generation. So it's the most, let's say, charismatic renewable technology. And it has, like you say, these old and deep connections to the sun, warmth, brightness, lightness. Yeah, I think it's a kind of collection of these two things. If it had been called hydropunk, then maybe it would be a completely different movement. I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah.
But solarpunk is based on natural resources and the sustainability. That's unavoidable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
We could have talked for hours about this, but thank you very much.
No, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
And maybe sometime we'll make another podcast about this.
Great.
Maybe some years in the future.
In 5 years' time, where are we now?
In a brighter future.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And to the biogas station sounds made by Anastasia Kisilova, we end this podcast. You have heard Riz Williams from the University of Glasgow in a conversation with me, Ole Jon Tveito.